Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 257, but who's counting? It's Monday, May 13th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's start first up with the story about disparities among in child mortality. This from Medical Express. Study shows rising child mortality in the U.S. has most impact on Black and Native American youth. Death rates among young Americans had been in decline for decades. However, these gains in public health have since been eclipsed by the rise in injury-related fatalities, including homicide, drug overdose, motor vehicle injuries, and suicide. While we saw that the overall pandemic all-cause mortality rate in the United States began to increase around 2020 and 2021 for Native American, Black, and Hispanic populations, pediatric mortality rates began increasing as early as 2014. Between 2014 and 2020, mortality rates increased by 37% in Black youth and 22% in Native American youth, while increasing less than 5% in White youth. This shift was primarily driven by disparities in injury-related deaths, according to the analysis. Between 2016 and 2020, nearly 13 in every 100,000 Black youth died by homicide, which is more than 10 times higher than the rate among White youth. During the same period, about 11 in every 100,000 Native American youth died by suicide, more than 2 times higher than the rate among White youth. The data also showed that firearm fatalities had become more frequent over time for both groups. Between 2013 and 2020, the risk of death from gun violence increased by 108% among Black youth and 124% among Native American youth. The observed disparities are not limited to deaths from injuries, as they also are seen in deaths from disease such as asthma, influenza, and heart failure. For instance, about 1 in every 100,000 Black youth died from asthma, nearly 8 times higher than the rate among White youth. So the increase in child mortality in recent years has been driven by increasing disparities between whites and others, particularly Black and Native American. Okay, well, next up, let's do an update on the bird flu. U.S. announces more than $175 million to track and contain H5N1, which is the bird flu. The Biden administration is making more than $175 million in funds available on a variety of fronts to try to halt the spread of avian influenza into cows and humans, administration officials said last Friday. To date, 42 herds of dairy cattle in 9 states have been infected with the virus known as H5N1. The key now is to make sure that we're restricting as much as we possibly can the movement of these lactating cows so that we ultimately allow the virus to peter out, eventually have that herd become virus-free, and eventually have the industry become virus-free. Well, I certainly hope that's the case. The funding the administration announced includes the following from Department of Health and Human Services: $34 million to develop assays for sequencing viruses, assessing circulating H5N1 viruses for any concerning viral changes, including increased transmissibility or severity in humans, and support the ability of public health laboratories to surge their testing abilities. $29 million to scale up existing efforts to monitor people who are exposed to infected birds and poultry, scale up contact tracing efforts and data reporting, support the collection and characterization of additional clinical specimens, and expand respiratory virus surveillance to capture more samples from patients with acute respiratory illness in different care settings. $14 million for genomic sequencing at CDC that supports enhanced monitoring and expand sequencing capability or capacity for highly pathogenic avian or bird flu. $8 million to analyze circulating H5N1 viruses to determine whether current vaccine candidates would be effective and develop new ones if necessary. The USDA also announced $98 million of its own funding, with more available if needed, including money to provide financial support of up to $2,000 per affected premises per month for producers who supply personal protective equipment to employees and/or provide outerwear uniform laundering for producers of affected herds who get their workers to participate in a USDA or CDC workplace and farmer and farm worker study. Workers who participate in the study are also eligible for financial incentives to compensate them for their time. Provide support up to 1,500 hours per affected premises to develop biosecurity plans based on existing secure milk supply plans. This includes recommended enhanced biosecurity for individuals that frequently move between dairy farms, including milk haulers, veterinarians, feed trucks, and avian influenza technicians. Reimburse producers for veterinarian costs associated with confirmed positive H5N1 premises, including costs incurred for treating cattle infected with H5N1, as well as fees for veterinarians to collect samples for testing. Veterinary costs are eligibly covered from the initial date of positive confirmation at that farm up to 10,000 hours per affected premises. Work with states to limit movement of lactating cattle between states. Additionally, USDA will work with and support the actions of states with affected herds as they consider movement restrictions within their borders to further limit the spread of H5N1 between herds to reduce further spread of this virus. And of course, the feds can only control the movement between the states. Each individual state has to figure out how to deal with movements within the state, and they're encouraged to monitor that. Okay, well, next up, also on the infectious disease front, this from Stat News, a dose of reality on adult vaccinations as they pay for themselves. The number of children who received their routine vaccinations declined during the pandemic, so public health officials have been focusing on getting kids back up to date. They should also be paying attention to adults, as new first-of-its-kind report quantifying the economic impact of adult immunizations makes clear. Researchers at the nonprofit Office of Health Economics based in London analyzed four adult vaccine programs for the flu, pneumonia, respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, and shingles across 10 different countries, including Australia, France, Japan, and the United States. They found that adult vaccination programs paid for themselves many times over, returning up to 19 times the initial investment in societal benefits. So I see that a lot of reports where there's an up to 19 times. So I actually went to the original report. This is the kind of reporting you get at Just for the Health of It. And so they have, that's the high estimate, and there's a low estimate. So the low estimate is $5 for every dollar invested. Still pretty darn good, but a range of $5 to $19 per dollar invested in societal benefits. Vaccines are among the most effective public health interventions in human history. Yet despite the clear benefits, the most recent data from the Commonwealth Fund indicate that the 2021 flu vaccination rate for U.S. adults was just 42%. By contrast, in the 2022-2023 school year, 93% of kindergartners received all state-required vaccines. This shows what a difference a concerted policy effort can make. Providers administer childhood vaccines based on a schedule set by the CDC and the Prevention Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The schedule for adult vaccines is much more complex. With that public health emergency in the rearview mirror, the U.S. has slipped into complacency, and demand for vaccines across the life course is falling. Fewer than half of adults received updated COVID-19 and flu shots last year. New vaccines offer adults protection against RSV and shingles, but most Americans eligible for these shots aren't getting them. Nearly 2 in 3 people aged 65 and older haven't received the shingles vaccine, which the CDC recommends that people age 50 and older get. Only 23% of people 65 and older have gotten the RSV shot, which is encouraged for every adult age 60 and over. Severe cases of flu, pneumonia, RSV, and even shingles can be deadly. Vaccines can prevent many of these deaths. A study by the Brown School of Public Health found that if COVID-19 vaccinations had stayed at their peak rate, the United States would have averted more than 300,000 deaths between January 2021 and April of 2022. As the U.S. population ages, the importance of boosting adult vaccination rates will only grow. Without a campaign to increase adult vaccination, experts estimate that rates of vaccine-preventable illnesses will rise over the next 30 years. That won't just lead to more human suffering, it will also impose staggering costs on major world economies. So yes, a good public health is also good for the economy. They're not in opposition to one another. Okay, well, next up, the latest on the attempts to try to get a pandemic treaty. This from MedPage Today. Nations struggle to draft pandemic treaty to avoid mistakes made during COVID. After the coronavirus pandemic triggered once unthinkable lockdowns, upended economies, and killed millions, leaders at the World Health Organization and worldwide vowed to do better in the future. Years later, countries are still struggling to come up with an agreed-upon plan for how the world might respond to the next global outbreak. A ninth and final round of talks involving governments, advocacy groups, and others to finalize a pandemic treaty was scheduled to end last Friday. The accord's aim? Guidelines for how the WHO's 194 member countries might stop future pandemics and better share scarce resources. But experts warn there are virtually no consequences for countries that don't comply. WHO's countries asked the UN Health Agency to oversee talks for a pandemic agreement in 2021. Envoys have been working long hours in recent weeks to prepare a draft ahead of a self-imposed deadline later this month, ratification of the accord at WHO's annual meeting, but deep divisions could derail it. For instance, U.S. Republican senators wrote a letter to the Biden administration last week critical of the draft for focusing on issues like, quote, shredding intellectual property rights and, quote, supercharging the WHO. They urged Biden not to sign off. Britain's Department of Health said it would only agree to an accord if it was, quote, firmly in the UK national interest and respects national sovereignty. And many developing countries say it's unfair that they might be expected to provide virus samples to help develop vaccines and treatments, but then be unavailable to afford them. This pandemic treaty is a very high-minded pursuit, but it doesn't take political realities into account, said Sarah Davies, a professor of international relations at Griffith University in Australia. For example, the accord is attempting to address the gap that occurred between COVID-19 vaccines in rich and poor countries, which WHO Director General said amounted to, quote, a catastrophic moral failure. The draft says WHO should get 20% of the production of pandemic-related products like tests, treatments, and vaccines, and urges countries to disclose their deals with private companies. There's no mechanism within WHO to make life really difficult for any countries that decide not to act in accordance with the treaty, Davies said. Adam Conrad Scott, a global health expert at Harvard University, said that similar to the global climate agreements, the draft pandemic treaty should at least provide a new forum for countries to try to hold each other to account, where governments will have to explain what measure they've taken. The pandemic treaty is not about anyone telling the government of a country what it can do and what it cannot, said Roland Dries, co-chair of WHO's negotiating board for the agreement. There are legally binding obligations under the international health regulations, including quickly reporting dangerous new outbreaks. But those have been flouted repeatedly, including by African countries during Ebola outbreaks and China in the early stages of COVID-19. Siri Moon, co-director of the Global Health Center at Geneva's Graduate Institute, said it was critical to determine the expected role of WHO during a pandemic and how outbreaks might be stopped before spreading globally. If we fail to seize this window of opportunity, which is closing, we'll be just as vulnerable as we were in 2019, she warned. Yangkong Hu, a senior legal and policy advisor at Doctors Without Borders, says it's unclear what might be different in the next pandemic, but hope that focusing attention on some of the glaring errors that emerged in COVID-19 might help. We will mostly have to rely on countries to do better, she said. That is worrisome. I must say, our anemic response globally to the global pandemic brings a lot of cynicism to me about collective efforts globally on a variety of fronts, whether it's a pandemic agreement or a plastics agreement or an international sea mining agreement, whatever it is. It seems that the issue of business interests and claims of national sovereignty, everybody has to be able to do their own thing regardless of the consequences globally. Well, when we're all in it together, we all have to do something together, or that those particular forces will beat us down once again. And of course, this represents just one of the many challenges we have in the modern world. Next up, I have a couple stories on mental health. This from USA Today. Mental health is bad for Americans. Depression and isolation are why. Tens of millions of people don't have relationships that provide meaning in daily life. No amount of federal money, no number of mental health workers or programs will solve that problem. We need a new way to think about mental health, one that recognizes every person's role in tackling the crisis that surrounds us. We all know that crises exist. After the COVID-19 pandemic, record numbers of people have reported mental health challenges. About 20% of U.S. adults, nearly 60 million Americans, have a diagnosable mental illness. Nearly 40% of high school students and half of high school girls say their mental health has struggled in recent years. Anxiety, depression, and suicide have soared. So has addiction, which about 1 in 5 Americans now struggle with. Amid this crisis, government at all levels is desperately trying to make a difference, mainly through new programs and funding streams. President Joe Biden's proposed 2024 budget, for instance, envisions a 44% increase in federal spending on the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. In the State of the Union address, he called for funding, quote, more mental health workers. And states like Florida and Virginia are now spending record amounts on mental health services. Yet more money and more workers aren't silver bullets. It's true that America has just one mental health professional for every 350 people who need help, but there's no credible path to close that gap. Even if we could, more than half of people with mental health challenges still avoid care because of social stigma. That helps explain why big federal funding increases before the pandemic didn't make much of a difference. Mental health challenges continue to rise. Clearly, some root cause is being unaddressed. Hence, the need for a new approach. The mental health advocates and substance abuse experts who my organization has worked with over the past decade show the way. They prove that the mental health crisis isn't just a clinical crisis, it's really a crisis of community. To be sure, clinical settings and clinical tools are essential for many people with mental health disorders, but it's also true that mental health is ultimately about psychological well-being. Everyone is looking for a life of meaning, and finding that life requires a supportive community. The famous psychologist Abraham Maslow said it better than I can. Based on his experience treating tens of thousands of patients, he realized that mental health challenges ultimately arise when people's deeper needs are not met. Most notably, when people lack relationships, belonging, and love, they get lonely, leading to anxiety and depression. Left unchecked, loneliness can ruin someone's life. What's happening in America supports Maslow's theory. Last year, the U.S. Surgeon General called loneliness an epidemic. An American Psychiatric Association poll conducted this January found that a third of adults say they have experienced feelings of loneliness at least once a week over the past year. About 30% of millennials had zero best friends, while Generation Z has been called, quote, the loneliest generation. The situation is so bad that some in Gen Z have posted, quote, friendship applications on social media. No wonder mental health is plummeting. Tens of millions of people don't have the relationships that provide meaning in daily life. No amount of federal money, no number of mental health workers or programs will solve that problem. The real solution is communities coming together and people reaching out to one another in a spirit of mutual support. And of course, that's not just at a very small scale. We need to change, in my opinion, the very society we live in, which produces alienation and isolation. Okay, and next up, to put an exclamation point on that last story, this from MedPage Today. 83% of adults with generalized anxiety disorder symptoms are undiagnosed. Almost a quarter of surveyed U.S. adults met criteria for generalized anxiety disorder, though the vast majority of them were undiagnosed, a retrospective cross-sectional study suggested here. Out of over 75,000 respondents to the online 2022 National Health and Wellness Survey, 23% screened positive for anxiety using the 7-item general anxiety disorder questionnaire. Daniel Carlin, Chief Medical Officer of MindMed, reported here at the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting. Of those who screened positive, 83% had never received a generalized anxiety disorder diagnosis. Most, 55% of the individuals screened positive, they had moderate symptoms, while 45% had severe symptoms. Last year, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended that all adults up to age 64 be screened for anxiety in the primary care setting, including for generalized anxiety disorder, in order to avoid delays in diagnosis and treatment. But Carlin explained that estimates of undiagnosed generalized anxiety disorder have been outdated or based on small samples. If the proportions identified by Carlin and his team were broadened to the entire U.S. population, it would represent around 59 million adults with generalized anxiety disorder, 49 million of whom are undiagnosed. There are a lot of people walking around with symptoms that are severe enough for them to have moderate or severe generalized anxiety disorder who've never been diagnosed. The burden of illness of undiagnosed generalized anxiety disorder is remarkably high. Carlin said that for a long time there has been a greater focus placed on diagnosing and treating major depressive disorder, but generalized anxiety disorder and major depressive disorder are overlapping diseases, he noted. We need to continue to recognize that distress comes in different flavors, and there's no single flavor is more important than any other. Let's make sure we're paying attention to anxiety as well as depression. A few characteristics stood out among adults with generalized anxiety disorder who were undiagnosed. They were more likely to be younger, male, smokers, alcohol drinkers, employed, and have a higher income than when compared with controls without symptoms or those already diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. The Work Productivity and Activity Impairment Questionnaire also showed that undiagnosed adults had scores for absenteeism, presenteeism, overall work productivity impairment, and activity impairment that were 3.1 times for absenteeism, 1.9 times higher for presenteeism, which is like basically being present but not really present, overall work productivity impairment 1.9 times greater, and for overall, just general activity impairment, 1.6 times higher than diagnosed adults. Interestingly, adults with undiagnosed generalized anxiety disorder were less likely to report certain comorbidities like depression at only 15% versus 79%, and pain 10% versus 44% than diagnosed adults. So the last one's kind of tricky there. So it basically seems that a lot of people who are either suffering from depression or pain are actually, you know, seeking out healthcare and are being diagnosed and treated for those conditions, whereas the people that are undiagnosed, that are outside the healthcare system, are much likely to get an anxiety diagnosis or a depression diagnosis. Like I said, they kind of go together. Now, the interesting thing about these undiagnosed folks, because they're younger, we know that the mental health crisis tends to affect people that are younger, male, which is not surprising since men are bad at seeking out help and have a lot of poor coping skills related to anxiety and depression, smokers, alcohol drinkers, employed, and those that have higher income. So this is something that I would posit is a very insightful kind of thing to understand, you know, where anxiety and depression is coming from, is from actually, even though you think that if you're making a lot of money and doing well and you're employed, you'd actually be less anxious or depressed, but that actually greatly increases your chance of being anxious or depressed. So clearly, work environments are not particularly satisfying, or at a minimum, are very anxiety inducing. We can do better. We do need to organize collectively to change our social situations, society as a whole, and perhaps particular our relationship with work and finding meaning in life, which of course is something that is a community project that takes all of us working together. Okay, well, next up, have a fascinating story that's sort of an example, another side effect of our go-go-go-go society. This is from Fortune magazine. Parents are drugging their kids to get them to sleep. Parenting brings many joys, but sleep deprivation is not one of them. So it's no wonder that moms and dads are willing to take some drastic measures in the form of sleep medications when it comes to getting their kids down for the night. New survey results from Sleep Doctor reveal that 79% of parents have given their child a substance to get them to sleep, with 66% using melatonin, 35% using Benadryl, and 20% turning to prescription sleep aids. Others reported using everything from herbal and over-the-counter aids to CBD, THC, and even alcohol. Kids need sleep for physical and mental health, with research showing it plays an important role in brain development, mood, cognitive performance, resiliency, language, and memory, according to the Sleep Foundation. Parents need sleep for many of the same reasons, including mood, brain performance, immunity, lower risk of heart disease and stroke, and according to a recent study, to avoid an uptick in stress levels. Parents, as a rule, miss out on vital rest when their kids don't snooze, and 25 to 50% of children and 40% of adolescents are affected by sleep problems like sleep apnea and night terrors, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, while insomnia affects 25% of children and 35% of adolescents. Ideally, it's better to change bedtime behaviors and modify them so a child can learn to fall asleep independently without the need of supplements. So, yeah, I mean, sleep is such a fundamental part of our life. You would assume that life should be ordered in such a way that we don't need to drug ourselves in order to go to sleep, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So, we know melatonin, while it's used as a drug, is actually doesn't fall under the FDA, so it's an unregulated prescription or unregulated additive or supplement that people can put into their life, adults or kids. And this has been increasing a lot in both adults and kids, but particularly kids in recent years. And unfortunately, because it's not regulated well, studies have shown that there's often less or a lot more melatonin than what's actually labeled. And there's been increase in poisoning that I've reported on earlier, you know, overdosing on it, basically. 35% of the parents giving their kids Benadryl, that's generally not a good idea. I mean, you give that specifically for, like, allergic reactions and such, but because it makes you drowsy, parents often, you know, you can use it to try to get them to go to sleep, but not a particularly good idea. And actually, 20% of the parents turning to prescription sleep aids. This is actually not recommended at all for children to use prescription sleep aids, drugs, basically. So, oh, wow, what a mess. But it fits kind of nice and neatly under the fact that the U.S. is the number one consumer of both illegal and legal drugs. So prescription drugs, giving ones that aren't even recommended, aren't appropriately used for children, perhaps not a surprise. Okay, well, let's turn our attention to the new most popular drug. This is from Medical Express. 1 in 8 U.S. adults have now used meds like Ozempic, finds poll. About 1 in 8 U.S. adults, or 12%, have tried a weight loss drug like Wegovy, Ozempic, Zepbound, or Mounjaro, a new Kaiser Family Foundation health tracking poll says. About 6% are taking one right now, the poll found. And this represents 16% of all U.S. prescriptions are for this class of drugs. Most patients say they use the drug, 61%, to treat a chronic condition like diabetes or heart disease, which can make it easier to obtain a prescription, the report says. And more than 2 in 5 using the drugs are diabetics, that's 43%. This makes sense given that the class of medications, GLP-1 agonists, was first developed as a treatment for type 2 diabetes. Further, about 1 in 4 people using the drugs, 26%, have heart disease. In March, Wegovy became the first weight loss medication to receive approval from the FDA as a means of reducing risk of heart attack and stroke. Only about 22% are taking the drugs because a doctor diagnosed them as specifically for overweight or obese, but nearly 38% take the drugs solely to lose weight, the findings show. These drugs can be costly, with list price topping $1,000 for a month's supply before insurance cover rebates and discount coupons. Insurance coverage for the drug seems to make little difference in how patients perceive their affordability. About half of people, 54%, who report having ever taken the drug said it was difficult to afford them, including one in five, 22%, who said it was very difficult. Similar percentage of people with insurance said it was difficult at 53% or very difficult at 23% to afford the drugs. About 8 in 10 adults, 82%, said they had heard at least a little about the drugs, and 3 in 10, 32%, said they had heard a lot about them. That marks an increase in awareness. Last July, only 1 in 5 or 19% said they knew a lot about the drugs. Also, about 8 in 10, 79%, of adults who have used the drug said they'd gotten a prescription for them from their doctor or specialist. About 11% got them from an online provider or website, 10% from a medical spa or an aesthetic medical center, and 2% from somewhere else. So these weight loss drugs are very popular, and we'll have to see how that pans out over the coming years. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is you listen to this show for a year, you'll know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if that should turn out to not be the case, I will gladly refund triple your money. Okay, well, if you've been paying attention to U.S. healthcare, the title of this next story may seem eerily familiar. This from Axios. U.S. healthcare is increasingly like a casino. For the decade-ish that I've been reporting on healthcare, insurance coverage has dominated conversations about who has access to care. But in the post-pandemic era, it's become clear that having insurance is only the first step towards receiving quality care. Where Americans live, their health status, and a range of socioeconomic factors increasingly determine their experience with the healthcare system, and in many cases that experience appears to be getting worse. Affordability, while critical, isn't synonymous with access. Long wait times for doctor's appointments, crowded emergency departments, complicated insurance requirements, and a shortage of local providers are all making things tougher on patients. For many people, whether they can get the care they need when they need it seems to come down to the luck of the draw. Provider shortages and a post-pandemic surge in demand for care have played a large role in today's squeeze. That's being felt all along the care continuum, whether you're trying to schedule an annual physical or waiting in the ER. Primary care especially is in short supply, which is particularly alarming given its role in keeping people healthy and from needing more specialized care down the road. The number of primary care doctors isn't keeping up with population increases, partly because it's hard to convince medical students graduating with mountains of debt to resist the draw of more lucrative specialties. Factors like administrative burden and burnout have meanwhile led to what's a pretty daunting exodus in primary care and a significant decrease in people going into primary care. Specialists are also being stretched thin. Staffing shortages, particularly among primary care physicians, are projected to only get worse, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. Who has bad luck when it comes to getting care can be predictable, or at times, it isn't really luck at all. The Silicon Valley, where I live, is a lesson on how money talks, says Kaiser Family Foundation President and CEO Drew Altman. Primary care docs and specialists have been lured to generous tech company benefits into concierge practices that have long waiting lists, leaving little left over for working and low-income people, most people, even if they can afford it. So this is another tier that just fragments our healthcare system. These concierge practices, they take on a much smaller number of patients that have to pay, you know, perhaps thousands of dollars a year extra to get that, concierge care. But of course, that means you have primary care docs in this instance that are being pulled away from the rest of the population, making those that are left over, the primary care providers left over to do even more work. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do some environmental stories. This is for Environmental Health Network. Agricultural plastic linked to buildup of harmful chemicals in wheat. The use of plastic films in farming has been linked to an accumulation of phthalates, an endocrine-disrupting chemical with serious health effects in both soil and wheat, according to a new study published in the Science of Total Environment. Residue left behind by the breakdown of plastic films in fields, increase the concentration of phthalates in multiple wheat tissues, including the roots and grains. High levels of phthalates were found in both seedlings and mature wheat. Plastic film residue also had significant impacts on the health of bacterial communities present in the soil, potentially impacting soil quality. The future food security conflict between phthalate pollution caused by plastic film residues and water scarcity in arid regions will be a great challenge. Why this matters? Plastic films are an agricultural tool used frequently by farmers in dry regions to help retain soil moisture and increase crop yields, with China alone using 136,000 tons of plastic film in 2020. Slow breakdown rates combined with inadequate removal practices have resulted in a large buildup of plastic debris in the soil. Phthalates are known to be carcinogenic, neurotoxic, toxic to reproduction, and more, so their presence in the soil and in crops poses a serious threat to the quality and safety of our food supply. Yep, being exposed to plastics before the crops even get out of the field. Okay, well, next up, have a follow-up to a very shocking story that I did a number of years ago. This from the LA Times. Concerning levels of DDT found in deep-sea fish off LA. Nothing is untouched. DDT found in deep-sea fish raises troubling concerns for food web. For several years now, one question has held the key to understanding just how much we should worry about the hundreds of tons of DDT that had been dumped off the coast of LA. How exactly has this decades-old pesticide, a toxic chemical spread across the seafloor 3,000 feet underwater, continued to re-enter the food web? Now, in a highly anticipated study, researchers have identified teeny zooplankton and mid to deep water fish as potential links between a contaminated sediment and the greater ecosystem. For the first time, chemical analyses confirmed that these deep sea organisms are contaminated by numerous DDT-related compounds that match similar chemical patterns found on the seafloor and animals higher up in the food chain. This DDT pollution happened several decades ago. There's no new source. It's been banned. But this old source is still polluting the ocean, the deep ocean biota, which is really alarming, said Yuna Ho, whose lab at San Diego State School of Public Health led the study's chemical analysis. We're not talking about zooplankton collected in 1960. We're talking about zooplankton collected now in the deep ocean that is still polluted with DDT. Ho's team had already found significant amounts of DDT-related chemicals in present-day dolphins and coastal feeding condors, and a recent study by another team even connected an aggressive cancer in sea lions to DDT. But even though DDT has clearly been accumulating at the top of the food chain, how the DDT reaches animals has been somewhat of a mystery. Key questions remain on whether it has been coming from more shallow sources, such as the Palo Verde's Shelf Superfund site, where DDT has been discharged for years via the sewer system, yikes, or from the deep sea sediment itself. The study, published in Environmental Science and Technology Letters, is one of many research efforts sparked by a 2020 Los Angeles Times report that detailed the little-known history of ocean dumping off the Southern California coast, and how the nation's largest manufacturer of DDT had for years disposed of its waste at sea. One team of scientists, in an attempt to map and scan the seafloor for DDT-related waste, discovered instead a multitude of discarded military explosives from the World War II era. Another team unearthed records showing that barrels of radioactive waste had also been dumped at sea. And during an urgent investigation into old and forgotten records, the U.S. EPA discovered that from the 1930s to the early 1970s, 13 other areas off the Southern California coast had also been approved for all manner of dumping, including disposal of various refinery byproducts and 3 million metric tons of petroleum waste. As for the DDT, scientists have so far confirmed that much of what's still sitting on the seafloor remains in its most potent form and is buried barely 3 inches deep, raising concerns about just how easily it could remobilize and spread by re-entering the food web. In a world dominated with concerns over microplastics and forever chemicals, DDT persists as an unresolved problem. Long after the pesticide was banned in 1972, following Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring. For environmental chemist Margaret Stack, the first author of this latest study, and fellow author Raymond Garcia, a doctoral candidate at Scripps, seeing once popular pesticides such as DDT continue to move so pervasively through the ecosystem makes them wonder about all the other chemicals still being used today without question. Chemicals that might also come back to haunt us many decades from now. I often find myself feeling frustrated when looking at this data and then seeing that we're still using chemicals without testing them, without understanding their impact, said Stack, a research specialist at San Diego State School of Public Health. It feels like we're not doing anything differently. How many more times, she said, are we going to go through the same story? Yep. But the almighty buck speaks. This next story from Environmental Health Network, Unilever revises its environmental goals amid financial pressures. Unilever has decided to scale back its environmental commitments, adjusting its sustainability targets to shorter-term goals due to geopolitical and economic challenges. Unilever's CEO announced revised sustainability goals, reducing the target for cutting virgin plastic use and delaying the timeline for making packaging recyclable. The company's decision aligns with the current global lack of strong environmental legislation, as discussed in the Global Plastic Treaty talks. Advocates argue that without stringent regulations, companies like Unilever will continue to prioritize financial performance over environmental commitments. Why this matters? Initially lauded for its aggressive sustainability goals, Unilever's adjustment raises questions about the challenges even major corporations face in transitioning towards more sustainable products or more sustainable practices. And of course, they really support environmental efforts as long as it doesn't get in the way with making a buck. Okay, well, let's end the regular reporting with a little bit of good news. This from the Center on Infectious Disease Research and Policy. More poultry associations join international effort to cut antimicrobial use in poultry. Seven more groups involved in poultry production have signed on to an international effort to reduce the use of antimicrobials on poultry farms. The organizations, which include poultry associations from several European countries and fast food giant Yum! Brands, announced that they'll adopt principles developed by the Transformational Strategies for Farm Risk Output Mitigation, or TRANSFORM project, to ensure the proper use of antimicrobials on poultry farms. Funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, the project is led by a consortium that includes Cargill, Heifer International, and the International Poultry Council, and uses antimicrobial stewardship principles developed by the Poultry Council. The principles encourage adopters to commit to taking action in four key areas. One, taking a risk-based approach around each instance of antimicrobial use. Two, adopting farm management practices that improve animal health and reduce the need for antimicrobials. Three, using antimicrobials only in compliance with national authorizations. And four, using medically important antibiotics only under a supervising veterinarian's diagnosis and oversight. Since 2021, a total of 26 organizations have now signed on to TRANSFORM, representing more than 40% of global poultry meat production. Hopefully more than a poultry effort. Okay, well, next up is our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 28 bonus stories this week, so let's get going. Let's start big. Bonus Article 1, half of Gaza water sites damaged or destroyed, BBC satellite data reveals. So this just shows the impact of a genocidal campaign. And of course, water is life. And if you don't have water, you have death, particularly through infectious disease. But bonus Article 2, patients in Gaza with chronic conditions need urgent interventions. And this is just the bread and butter of basically the healthcare system, and where death occurs is generally chronic conditions around most places in the world. And of course, if you have no healthcare system and you don't have any medications, those normal ongoing chronic conditions are going to lead to death a lot more prematurely. And of course, we can expect, even with the increase in bombing and shooting, those kind of violent injuries and deaths, you will actually see the vast majority of those deaths coming from, quote, silent deaths, whether it's from infectious disease, from unclean water, or chronic conditions that cannot be treated on top of all the stress. Bonus Article 3. Medical residents in the U.S. are increasingly avoiding states with abortion restrictions. So this is just kind of another one in the series of my meditations on the divide between red and blue states. And this is confirming a previous research showing that medical residents are being affected in where they want to get trained and where they want to serve, and they're avoiding red states. Bonus Article 4, 62% of young adults would not want to live in a state with an abortion ban. So this is even much more broad, and about half of those, 30% of young adults, would definitely not live in a state with an abortion ban. So this may change our demographics nationally for years to come. Bonus Article 5, Governor Mike DeWine says 24-hour waiting period for abortion should remain in Ohio law. There's no really good medical reason for that. It's just another barrier to receiving abortion health care. But of course, they're saying, well, it was enacted while there was still, Roe was still the law. But the good thing about the Ohio constitutional amendment that was passed is it actually is stronger than Roe v. Wade, has more protections. So hopefully these extraneous barriers, they're extraneous in the sense that they're unnecessary, but they actually are actual barriers. Those will fall, hopefully. Bonus Article 6, very interesting article. Sexual harassment rampant in OB-GYN field, despite majority female workforce. Power dynamics may be more critical than gender. So if you're interested in that kind of topic, that's a really good read. Bonus Article 7. About 56% of pregnant smokers quit during pregnancy. Good news on the OB-GYN front. And kudos to pregnant folks who are smokers, that the majority of them are able to quit, which is hard to do. Actually, a very successful quit smoking programs usually have about a 30 or 35% success rate, you know, after a year of attempting to quit. Bonus Article 8. Privately insured new moms face about $3,000 in additional out-of-pocket spending. So this is privately insured new moms compared to women of the same age who are not having a child have to dish out about $3,000 in out-of-pocket spending. Yikes. We should make sure that there are not financial barriers or burdens to new families. Bonus Article 9, drug makers in Medicare negotiations spent more on shareholder payments and marketing than R&D last year. So a big a perennial complaint from drug companies is that, oh, these high prices are related to all the expensive research and development that we do. This has proven not to be true in the past, and it's not true today. And in a similar story, Bonus Article 10, Amgen drug maker plows ahead with costly, highly toxic cancer dosing despite FDA challenge. So they tested their drug that had a lot of serious side effects. With a quarter of the dose, it basically was 90% as effective, but cut way down on the highly toxic side effects. But the FDA can't force them to use a smaller dose, and they make a ton of money. You're talking this drugs that cost tens of thousands of dollars. So they're keeping it at the higher dose. Bonus Article 11. Pre-approval plan proposed for Medicare Advantage assures, quote, no prior authorization without prior authorization, Senate Budget Committee chair says. Oh, man, you got to laugh sometimes at the headlines. But actually, no prior authorization without prior authorization. It's called regulation. So maybe if we regulate Medicare Advantage insurers to not do all these pre-authorizations, like traditional Medicare does not have these pre-authorizations. Let's just say that Medicare Advantage, these private plans, cannot do the same. Everybody hates it except the people making a ton of money off of it. Bonus Article 12. Workers' legal battles over health costs could change workplace benefits. So there's been some new regulations in recent years that are allowing workers or employees to demand more accountability about how the money that they spend on health premiums through their employers are actually used in a reasonable way. Of course, that's America, where you basically got to sue to get what you want. But hey, it's happening. Bonus Article 13. Caring for young caregivers, a hidden population of 14 million under age 24. So usually we think about caregivers as taking care of elderly, but there are a lot of people with various disabilities or conditions that young caregivers, and this is, we're talking about people under age 24, 14 million, that's about 30% of the total caregiver population. So it's a population that deserves care themselves. Bonus article 14, colorectal cancer cases more than triple among teens over two decades. So this is another story and a long string of stories about things that are considered chronic diseases that develop over many decades are happening much, much earlier in life. Very, very serious warning, kind of a canary in a coal mine type of thing. The good news is that the numbers of these are still relatively small. But when you have three times as many teens over a period of 20 years getting a condition, something is going on. Bonus article 15. Study raises concern over exposure to flame retardant chemicals used in some automobile seats. Probably not necessarily, because most of the problems with fire are not, you know, with the seats, are usually the engines or the gas tank or whatever. And of course, if once the seats do get on fire, you tend to have an even more toxic plume of smoke with all these chemicals in there. But hey, you know, we have chemicals, toxic chemicals in our couches at home, so why not have it in your car? Bonus article 16. Plastic everywhere. Even at the UN's plastic-free conference, industry insiders were given access to vital negotiations. Yeah, unfortunately, that's a common story. The big money comes in, the industry insiders, and sure enough, they're driving the fact that we'll continue to have plastic everywhere. And a very interesting longer read, bonus article 17. After decades fighting big tobacco, Cliff Douglas now leads a foundation funded by his former adversaries. So this foundation was funded solely by Philip Morris, who makes 60% of its money on tobacco sales. And now they've distanced themselves from that, saying they won't take any more tobacco money. But a very interesting read of seeing how it's very hard to escape the big money of big tobacco and other industries. Bonus article 18. Study finds discrimination accelerates aging at molecular level. You know, there's a lot of studies showing that discrimination, racism, and the like ages people prematurely. This is just more evidence that connecting how that happens at the biological molecular level. Bonus article 19. FDA considers updating blood donation guidelines to keep nations safe supply safe from malaria. I had to include this one just because it's one of those things where, you know, it might prevent a case of malaria every year or two. Literally, that's about the order of magnitude we're talking about here. But also, I had malaria as a kid, and when I'm a regular blood donor, when I give blood, they ask a question, have you ever had malaria? Of course, I had it when I was like 5 weeks old, and I have to say yes, and they usually have to bring somebody over, and it's just kind of a big waste of time. So I don't know. It's just one of those things where trying to achieve zero risk with our blood donation sometimes gets a little kooky. Bonus article 20. Bird flu keeps rewriting the textbooks. It's why scientists are unsettled by the U.S. dairy cattle outbreak. So there's a lot of wily viruses out there, and bird flu tends to be one of those. And I've got a series of those bonus articles here. 21. Cows have human flu receptors, study shows, raising stakes on bird flu outbreak in dairy cattle. So this is one of the things we didn't know before. So cows have two forms of flu receptor. One's a human and one that's present in other mammals. So we're learning more, and that's scary stuff that we're learning because it's one more step towards moving the bird flu into humans as a possibility. Bonus article 22. As livestock move around the country, so does H5N1 or bird flu. The U.S. needs real-time tracking of livestock movements. So livestock, you know, generally born in one place, transported to another, sold, you know, either for milk production or as meat and processed in another location. So they consider a lot of these livestock places kind of like airports, you know, the cows just moving in and out. So yes, need to keep track of that. And actually, if you look at livestock, there are way more livestock in the U.S. than there are human beings, so it's a big airport. Most of those, 90% of those, are chickens. Bonus article 23, H5N1 communication has been strictly for the birds. Didn't the federal government learn anything from COVID? So this is about transparency and really just building trust in communications. You know, the federal government really just needs to learn that you tell people what you know, you tell them what you don't know, and you tell them how you're going to tell them about things as you learn them in the future. Your communications plan to build trust, essential. Bonus article 24. Farmers resist push for workers to wear protective gear against bird flu virus. So nobody wants to wear a lot of protective gear. Some of it's not particularly good in a hot environment. But also, from a business point of view, you're seeing both the workers and the farmers, the owners themselves, are worried about being branded with kind of, you know, bird flu virus outbreak. So just like, let's pretend it's not there. Bonus article 25, though, officials pledge reimbursements for dairy farms impacted by avian flu. This is one way to kind of soften the blow. And the story that I reported in the regular reporting talked about a lot of measures to try to help farmers deal with this. Bonus article 26. Track local air quality at airnow.gov as fire seasons begin. So I'd put this one on your computer, airnow.gov. This will give you the air quality from several different measures, and it has a link to you can get the fire map. And of course, Toledo today was actually the first day that I saw the stuff coming down from Canada. That fire season's already begun, and it's affecting our air quality. Bonus article 27. We know late night screens are bad for sleep. How do you stop doom scrolling in bed? So if that's an issue for you, there's some good suggestions there. Bonus article 28. How much do our thoughts shape our health? Mind-body connections are powerful. This is a good longer read to give you some insights and to truly recognize that these mind-body connections are very powerful. So think good, healthy thoughts, my friends. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.